Comrades, it's my great honor and privilege to welcome and to introduce the Chief of the Defense Staff, General Walt Natenshuk. The General was originally from Winnipeg, so let's all give him an Anavets welcome back home. In 1970, General Natenshuk joined the Royal Canadian Air Cadets here in Winnipeg and spent 5 years with them. And then when he grew up, he joined the Army.
How long's this going to be?
You snuck up on me.
How's this going to be there, General? Oh, well, you're not going to tell them all that stuff, are you?
You got it. You're just going to have to put up with
okay.
He learned his basic soldier skills working his way from tank troop leader to commanding officer of the Royal Canadian Dragoons. General Natenshuk's operational experience was gained with over 4 years while on NATO duty in Germany in the early 1980s and while on UN duty in Cyprus in 1984. In 1994, in the former Yugoslavia, he was a chief of operations with the British forces in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and later as Chief of Land Operations at the headquarters of the United Nations Protective Force in Zagreb, Croatia. He commanded the Royal Canadian Dragoons here in Winnipeg during the floods of 1997, as well as cleaning up all the mess in Ottawa of the 1998 ice storm. Later in 98, he was the Canadian Contingent Commander back in Bosnia-Herzegovina. He served as Deputy Commanding General of the 3rd United States Corps in Fort Hood, Texas. And in 2004, he deployed with 3 Corps to Baghdad, Iraq, first as the Deputy Director of Strategy, Policy, and Plans, and subsequently as a Deputy Commanding General of the Multinational Corps. He has filled various staff appointments, including serving at Royal Military College, on the Army Headquarters Staff, National Defense Headquarters, and more recently as Vice Chief of Defense Staff. General Natenshuk was promoted to his present rank on the 2nd of July 2008 when he became Chief of the Defense Staff. He and his wife Leslie have 3 children, Margaret, William, and John, who are serving right at this moment with the Navy, Air Force, and Army respectively. And now I'm going to say a few words about the General himself.
Uh-oh.
You're too close. Besides being a dynamic leader, the General and his wife have tried very hard to improve the way wounded soldiers and military families are cared for. In referring to his efforts to care to strengthen the care for wounded soldiers, one officer said, "Everything for him is very personal. He takes a very personal interest in it, as does Mrs. Natenshuk." At CDS, he visited the troops in Afghanistan 16 times. And has rarely missed a repatriation ceremony for our fallen as they're brought home to Trenton. And if I may, I'd like to add a few of my personal reflections on the General, because he and I have seen a lot of each other in Ottawa in the last couple of years. General Natenshuk being one of the most vibrant speakers that I've ever heard, in my opinion, he's also the perfect soldier's general. I've seen him at many commemorative ceremonies in Ottawa, and without fail, he never leaves the event until he has a word or two with the troops involved, always complimenting them and thanking them for their performance and rewarding them with his famous smile. Comrades, we are most fortunate to have General Walt Natenshuk with us today. As you know, he's currently in wind-down mode after having served 37 years in the Canadian Forces, with the past 4 years in its highest ranking and most demanding appointment as Chief of the Defense Staff. General, you do us great honor by finding time in your very busy schedule to be here today. We very much appreciate it. Now, on behalf of all of us in Anavets, thank you so much. Comrades, please join me in welcoming the Chief of Defense Staff, General Walt Natenshuk.
Neil, Jerry, distinguished comrades, ladies and gentlemen. You know, after an introduction like that, I ought to just sit down. Okay, just sum up right there and sit down and say that's all, and that's enough. But Jerry, thank you for a very kind introduction. I'm humbled. I'm very humbled. But before I talk, I just want to find out who I have here in front of me. Who here has served with the Army? Hands up. The Navy, hands up. The Air Force, hands up. Okay. Now I got to figure out where you're from. Who are the Toronto Maple Leaf fans out here? Les Canadiens de Montréal. The Canuck fans, where are you? And where are the Jets fans? Hands up, Jets fans. There you go. Okay, there you go. Okay. And we're all in mourning because there's no darn season this year. Anyway, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm thrilled to be with you. You know, it's funny when people say, hey, are you done yet? Are you finished this whole CDS gig thing? Yesterday morning, I was at the Army Run. It was a great day. And here's a picture of the Governor General and the Minister. And we're all out there in a very brisk, almost a Winnipeg morning out there, about before the run. But people are coming up to me saying, are you done yet? Are you done? And I was thinking, it's kind of like the Monty Python skit where the guy says, I'm not dead yet, okay? I'm not dead yet. I'm still hanging in there. It was a terrific day yesterday. 18,000 runners out there on the streets of Ottawa. And the level of support across the city, across the province, folks coming in from across the country. In fact, Mary Chaput, the deputy minister who was just out there, she was out there running the 5-kilometer run. Let's give her a round of applause and thanks. Hey, but listen, I'm thrilled to be back here in Winnipeg. I find that the further I am from Ottawa, the happier I am. Okay? I just want you to know I came here in the Challenger this morning, okay? And I'm going right out to Washington, actually, to join Minister Blaney and all those folks who are focused on mental health. But, you know, I'm thrilled to be here. And when Neil invited me to come on out, I wanted to be here because the strongest supporters of the Canadian Forces are right here in this room, and it's all of you. And on behalf of all of my fellow Manitobans who are clearly in that back corner over there, indeed, I want to welcome all of you here. You know, you have a province here and a city with a proud tradition of service. And as Jerry talked about my time in Air Cadets going out to Grant and Keniston, where two Patricias was out there, and he used to go out there every Thursday night. But I'd ride on the old William bus, and I'd go up Valor Road. You know, Valor Road, where three great Victoria Cross winners had originated from that road. And in me, it instilled a sense of service, a tradition of service that is in this city, that is in this province. And for all of you to be here, it is only right and fitting. Before I go any further, I do want to commend Neil McKinnon for his outstanding work over these past 2 years. And I just want to say, Neil, thank you for all you've done for this organization, but also for the Canadian Forces. Let's give him a round of applause. And I want to add my thanks to Georges Beaulieu for accepting the responsibility of leading this great institution into the future, and look forward to the great support for the Canadian Forces into the future. So thanks very much, George. This morning, I want to offer you my sense of where we are in the Canadian Forces. So an overview from an operational sense and what we're doing to modernize the force and how we're taking care of our wounded, our ill, and our injured. But I just want to say before I kick off that the Canadian Forces right now is basically between combat missions. We've been rolling on a high tempo of operations, almost historical, really since the Korean War. You know, between January and June of 2010, I had 12,000 folks committed on operations. I had just about 3,000 in Afghanistan, over 4,000 in Vancouver with the Winter Olympics. I had another 4,000 in Fort Irwin, California, preparing to go to Afghanistan. And at the same time, Haiti popped up, and we sent another 2,000 sailors, soldiers, airmen, and women. And we pulled out the stops and achieved operational success on everything that we've done. But now we're between those two combat operations. But I tell you, the real driver over this past while has been Afghanistan. You know, just a few months ago, back in June, I was able to visit Afghanistan, and I was struck by how much progress had occurred over a short period of time. And as Jerry said, I've been there 16 times over the past just a few years. And I was reflecting flying into Kabul, Afghanistan, back in June. And as we were descending in this aircraft, and it was a commercial aircraft, I was thinking back about my first trip when we landed in Afghanistan. Here I have flak jacket, helmet, you know, all of the body armor ready to rock and roll in the back of a Hurt, corkscrewing, pulling 2 and 3 G's going into Kandahar airfield, worried about getting shot down. Well, in June when I traveled in, I was in a golf shirt. And I was on this airline. It was the Afghan airline. They call it Safi. And I got a remark to you, and I know all of you have flown in from across the country, but Safi Airlines gave me very friendly and courteous cabin crew, a very delicious full meal, and they did not lose my luggage. And I thought, holy smokes, things have changed here in Afghanistan. But really, you know, as we speak, we have just over 900 men and women of the Canadian Forces who are in Kabul and a town just north of Kabul called Mazar-e-Sharif, and they're working hard to professionalize the Afghan army and the Afghan police, and they're doing it with great professionalism and courage, because the risks don't go away. The threats are still there, and our folks are doing an amazing job. The Afghan security forces, both police and army, are now over 300,000 men and women in the Afghan security forces. And they have responsibility for more than half of the country. And the other half, NATO forces still have the lead, but that transfer is still happening. And they're taking responsibility of security so that the economy can grow and that boys and girls can go to school. And I know there's a lot of folks in this room who have deployed in operations, and the hope is always on young kids and when they can go to school and their parents have confidence that their kids will be safe going to school, then there is hope. And I just want to tell all of you that my assessment, there is hope in those great kids in the future. You can clap, it's okay. But also as a result of Afghanistan, your men and women in uniform, the Canadian Forces, are a combat-proven and confident force. Over the past 10 years, we've rotated about 40,000 sailors, soldiers, airmen and women in Afghanistan. And they have come home to teach the rest of the force and all those great recruits coming in from in the front door. Less than half the troops in Kabul right now, less than half of them, have had multiple tours before. And when I talked to them in June, you have folks there on 2, 3, and 4 tours before, and they're there because they want to be there. And they have connived and manipulated, done everything to get onto the tour. You know what I'm talking about. You know, when you put on a uniform, you want to go somewhere, you want to make a contribution for peace and security. And that's still the same today. You know, they're committed to making a difference in the professionalism of the Afghan security forces, and they're pushing it hard, because we have until the end of March of 2014 to make a difference. And Canadians, I find, unlike any other, can partner and build confidence with their Afghan brethren, just as we did in Bosnia and Kosovo and Cyprus and the Middle East before that. Now, on the naval front, 2 weeks ago, I was in Charlottetown, and we welcome home HMCS Charlottetown. I heard some Navy clapping back here. Oh, there's a submariner beside me here. I better watch it now. It's okay, I got a picture of submarine. But anyway, the Charlottetown, I mean, they had their tails high because they had an absolutely outstanding tour or patrolling in the Arabian Sea on a counterterrorism operation. And the Charlottetown's a smaller one up here, but it's not about size. That's the USS Abraham Lincoln in the back there, in the Charlottetown in the foreground. But only last year, this same ship, the Charlottetown, but with a different crew, was patrolling the inshore waters off of Libya, a town called Misrata, where she was shelled from the shore batteries. And that is the first time that a Canadian ship has come under hostile fire since the Korean War. And I got to tell you, listen, they're not about to shoot at that other ship, though. But their training kicked in. And they did an extraordinary job, and all of us should be very, very proud of our Navy. Turning to the Air Force, this past June, we held our annual exercises, Maple Flag, up in Cold Lake, Alberta. And during that exercise, we dropped a lot of training bombs out there in Wainwright, Alberta. It was a great exercise. Now, last year, We had to cancel that exercise because we were too busy dropping live bombs in Libya. Okay, but part of that was in support of the United Nations mandate alongside of our NATO partners, and indeed in implementing that mandate to protect civilians from a very hostile regime. And every one of our qualified fighter pilots rotated through that mission. So I gotta tell you, the Canadian Air Force, the Royal Canadian Air Force, their fighter pilots have a huge amount of operational experience. But we also rotated in all of our Airbus tankers into the theater, our maritime patrol aircraft, the Auroras went through there. And in fact, even the Herc tankers from Winnipeg were out there providing great support. But also, we are still wearing our UN Blue Berets. And we don't talk about them enough. But we are still in those classic... How many here have worn the Blue Beret? Hands up. There you go. As I have. Okay? And we're still in those classic operations. We still have one person in Cyprus. Okay? But we're still in the Sinai, on the MFO. We're still in UNIFIL. We're still in UNSO. But besides that, we've moved into places like the Congo. In fact, a lot of folks started in the Congo back in 1960 and also moved into Sudan and South Sudan. So we're still involved in all of those UN operations. Now here at home, we've been really busy as well. You know, for my accounting, we launch up to 3 search and rescue missions a day. I'm saying that there for our great ombudsman from Veterans Affairs. The Canadian Forces have been very busy. You know, on average, we save about 1,200 lives a year on search and rescue missions. And we operate from coast to coast to Arctic coast up in the north. And I always reflect upon that. And you might have heard me tell this story before, but just a few years ago, I was up in Alert. And we're up in Alert, and I was talking to a bunch of search and rescue guys. They had just finished a search and rescue mission almost at the North Pole. We had an Australian visiting Canada. This soldier had been part of the British Grenadier Guards. He's a big man, 6'6", pushing 300 pounds, but he's a big man. He was going to walk from Canada to the North Pole, pulling 2 sleds over the Arctic ice. People do this stuff. Okay, and now he was out there with his cross-country skis crossing the ice at a distance of 700 nautical miles. 500 nautical miles north of Alert, he falls in through a crack of the ice and into the drink, okay? And he is totally immersed. Anyway, he's a big, strong man, and after 10 minutes in the icy, frigid waters of the Arctic, he pulls himself up, gets a toboggan up, sets up a tent, finds his beacon, hits his emergency beacon, and he gets in the tent, and he prepares to die. 6 hours later, a Twin Otter from 440 Squadron of Yellowknife flies over and brings in and directs in a helicopter with search and rescue technicians from 103 Squadron, Gander, Newfoundland. Okay, so it lands on the ice, and I talk to the lead SAR-tech, who's a great Newfoundlander. Any Newfoundlanders in the room here? There you go. Great Newfoundlander. And I talk to the lead sergeant. I said, what did he say? What happened? He says, well, sir, I came out of that helicopter, gumbooting her over to the tent, and the Australian, who's just frigid, he thinks he's going to die, he sticks his head out of the tent, and he says 2 things. 1, I have no money. 2, I have no insurance. And that sergeant from 103 Squadron, Gander, Newfoundland, says in the finest accent from the Rock, she's okay, boys. You's in Canada. She's all free. We live in a great country. Thanks very much. But I tell you, we're also on high readiness to help folks when natural disasters kick in. And again, I was standing out here on Main Street back in 97 for the great flood. But also, I was thrilled to be out here with Minister McKay last year, and we were slinging sandbags there with 2 PPCLI out there in Portager Prairie, and it was absolutely fantastic how we answered the call. And I do want to remark on our great reservists from 38th Brigade that are right here in Winnipeg, and those folks had been in Shiloh. They had just returned home after an exercise. They were supposed to be home for a bit of a break, have have dinner on Mother's Day, and we turned them around right away the same day, and they were out there slinging sandbags for days on end. And I tell you again, anytime that we can get out there and support Canadians, in my view, that is our vital mission, so that Canadians feel secure no matter where they are across the country. And again, we did this out here. But after 2010 and 2011 and all those operations, we are now at a more stable operational tempo. But I tell you, as I said before, that our men and women, wherever they serve, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Special Forces, they want to deploy. And the Canadian Forces Chief Warrant Officer, Mr. Bob Carew, whenever we go out and do our town halls with the troops, be it on a ship, a squadron, or battalion, the first question when I do my town halls, first question from everybody, sir, where are we going to go next? And my answer, I don't have a clue. But I tell you, and it's never been that way, eh? We have never been able to predict the Bosnians or the Kosovos. Nobody predicted Afghanistan, right? But you have to be ready. So I tell them, okay, boys and girls, keep your training up and keep your kit packed up and be ready to rock and roll. And I tell you, that's what they're doing right now. Because indeed, the world is a turbulent place. You can read the news as well as I can. There's stuff happening around the world. And I know that our allies want the Canadian forces, our men and women, by their side, because just like you, things have not changed amongst the finest in the world, and we can be trusted. So that while the operational tempo has not dropped, the training tempo has increased hugely. In fact, we've got a lot of work to do to catch up, because people bypass a lot of leadership training, a lot of trades training, in order to go on a tour. That's how desperate they wanted to go. And indeed, we're in an intense period of recuperation of individual and collective training right now. Focus on the full spectrum of peacekeeping training, humanitarian ops training, and combat training, but also Arctic training. And a lot of those young soldiers and sailors and airmen we have right now, they have never been in the Arctic before. And so we were able, and this is an exercise from Arctic Ram, where one brigade went up to Yellowknife with almost half of the brigade. And again, a lot of those soldiers, the first exposure they have to the Arctic. But we're also busy overhauling the equipment that we really pushed hard in Afghanistan in combat, and we're trying to modernize the force. We've done well in the Army. I got to tell you, with the Leopard tanks we've received, the M777 gun that is shown right here being slung under a Chinook, and we've modernized our light armored vehicles. But we need to move forward with our tactical patrol vehicles, as well as the close combat vehicles. In the Air Force, I believe that we've done really well because we've purchased the C-17 aircraft, the C-130J Hercules, and the Chinook helicopters. But we still need to replace the CF-18s, the Aurora Maritime Patrol aircraft. We need to get that fixed-wing search and rescue aircraft and the UAVs. And we are still working to replace the Sea Kings. Now, I got to tell you, I gave a speech a little while ago in Victoria, at the old Union Club there in Victoria. And I had a group like this in the room, and I gave my little pitch like I did just now here, and then I took some questions and answers. And one gentleman, he stands up and he says, hey, listen, I got posted to NDHQ in 1972 to be on the Sea King replacement project. How's it going? So we're going to celebrate 50 years of Sea King next year. But I tell you, I've seen and I've touched the Cyclone helicopter. We're still figuring it out, but that's a good helicopter when it'll come up online, and we'll get it soon enough. But even the Army and the Air Force, we've made huge strides. My biggest concern, the Navy. I knew I would have one fan up here. But I tell you, we need to build ships. It's the hardest thing to do. You know, you can go out and touch and buy a C-17. You can go out and buy an M777 cannon. You can buy a tank. But you got to build ships. And it's the hardest thing that a country can do, because you need to have strong decision making over a decade and more. Okay, we have not built a warship in Canada since 1996. HMCS Ottawa came off the rails, or whatever you call it there in the shipyard, right? But we need to replace those 40-year-old oilers and those 40-year-old destroyers. At the same time, we need to acquire a new fleet of Arctic offshore patrol ships. I was also thrilled being with the minister out in RIMPAC this past summer, and we saw our submarine HMCS Victoria put in a warshot, a war torpedo, into a hulk and sunk her in seconds. Absolutely thrilled that we're back in the submarine business with a full wartime capable ship. But I've told the Navy we got to move out and support the national shipbuilding strategy. We got to move out on this very, very quickly. And I've said to our Navy, I want you to be user friendly. I want you to pick a design. I want you to pick a color and get on with it. They hate that line. But if we're a strong and professional force, it's because of our people. It's because of the men and women who wear the uniform. And I hold that man for man and woman for woman, we don't take a backseat to anybody around the world. And we've got the nicest mittens too. And I'm not talking about only the regular force, I'm talking about regulars and reserve, one family, one team, doing the business together. You know, these men and women, the reservists especially, share the same challenges, the same threats, and way too often, the same sacrifices. So whether they're heading out the door in their combats for a week-long or two-week concentration, or whether they're wearing their civvies and going to work or sports, doesn't matter. You know, our reservists are outstanding ambassadors of the Canadian Forces, and they ensure that the Canadian Forces stay connected to the communities across this great country of ours. I'm thrilled to say that in terms of our attrition, our men and women want to stay in the Canadian Forces. We have a historic low attrition rate right now. 4% is the voluntary release rate in the Canadian Forces today, which is absolutely fantastic. And we have lineups of young men and women who want to come in the front door and join the Canadian Forces. We're also allowing a lot of component transfers, reserve back to regular and back and forth. Folks are re-enrolling. People have got out during that decade of darkness in the 90s, and they want to come back in. In fact, it was incredible when I was in Afghanistan. Folks who had got out of the Armor Corps because we're getting out of the tank business, getting back in. Gunners getting back in. Folks who want to work on the C-17s and C-130Js or Chinooks coming back in. And it's absolutely tremendous because they bring in the skills, but they also bring in the experience. And that's what we value so, so much. But many of our folks are also wounded. Wounded mentally and wounded physically. This is a picture from yesterday at the Army Run, and that gentleman on the right is now Sergeant Rick Ricard, who was a great Rimi combat wrench bender with me in the RCD when he got injured actually in an industrial accident in Petawawa. And to see him out there as a sergeant, he passed his leadership qualification courses while he was injured. And here he is, the first promotee while he's carried that handicap of that he had suffered so long ago. So absolutely thrilled and what he has done. But we're doing so much to improve how we handle our wounded, our ill, and our injured, how they get access to the services and the benefits that they need. And we've set up a whole range of programs and initiatives, like helping our injured members make modifications to their homes or their quality of life so they have a level of independence. Setting up peer support services for those men and women as well as for their families. Or working with those who wish to transition to civilian life to help them to find work or return to school. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've made some strides to change our culture in the Canadian Forces to support these folks through the recovery, rehabilitation, and the reintegration. And the creation of the Joint Personnel Support Units, bringing together all of the agencies within the Canadian Forces and our great partners at Veterans Affairs in a one location, you know, across the country, has been, from my view, absolute magic. But each case is an individual and unique case. Each case is difficult. And so the cookie-cutter approach often does not work. And I tell you what, we are not perfect, but we're better. And I've got to strive that we are better. And the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and women now know that they can walk into the JPSU and get the support they need. And if they recover, they can go back to their battalions, their squadrons, and their ships. And I tell you, I make these points when I'm in theater aboard ship, and it's tremendous after the town hall. I'll have a sailor come up to me and say, "Hey, sir, I recovered and I just did a deployment." You know, I'd been down to the Royal Ottawa Hospital and learned that there is a connection between PTSD and sleep disorder. If you treat the sleep disorder, you are treating the PTSD. And I was aboard the HMCS Fredericton. She was coming home from the Gulf. I mentioned this in the petty officer's mess when I was in there with the boys and girls. And a PO came up to me, "Hey, sir, you just described me. Because I got treated for sleep disorder, I had PTSD from an early tour, and I'm back in the game." And then back in Kabul this past June, I had a young military police master corporal come up to me and said, "Hey, sir, you just described me. And I'm back in the saddle because I've recovered, I'm good to go. And thank you for pushing this button and emphasizing this across the board, because we need to do that." We now have a sense of compassion in the force. And sometimes they got to keep this in mind. You know, I got three kids in the force, and they tell me about this all the time. Because they say, "Hey, Dad, you're old school." You hear that ever? Okay, you're old school. But the old school was, you put your game face on. You know, the sergeant major tells you to suck it up. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And we got to be careful about that. Because when you do that, people do not admit they have difficulty. Okay? And again, I'm a man. Okay, I'm a man. And I have some weaknesses. I have some weaknesses. When I'm really, really lost, I generally don't stop at a gas station and ask for directions. How many of you guys admit to that? How many guys admit to that? Okay. There you go. Okay, but here's another failing. Guys don't ask for help when they're feeling sick. Okay? Generally, men don't ask for help when they're feeling sick. And it takes every bit of cajoling to get you into a MIR or a sick room or the hospital to get you figured out, right? You're darn right. Because when I'm out there and the women are going, "Absolutely." The guys like, "Hey, that's not me." But the women are going, "Yeah, all right." I was out in the JPSU in Edmonton, Joint Personnel Support Unit in Edmonton. I had about 30 guys with PTSD around me. I said, "Okay, how many of you guys, be honest here, how many of you guys walked in on your own? How many of you walked in that front door on your own?" The answer? Zero. Not a one. It was their battle buddies. It was their shipmates. It was their wingmen. It was their families, the kids, the spouses, the parents saying, "Johnny, Janie, you get in there and ask for help." And so you got to create this environment to allow folks to walk in, ask for help, so they get themselves sorted out, and then get back onto the ship, get into the squadrons, and get back on battalion. And that's what they want to do. And so rather than say, "Suck it up," it's called tough love. It's doing that diagnosis right away, figuring out what the problem is, getting them to really good professional assistance, have a very supportive network of all their battle buddies around them, a strong family, because often it's the family who sees the first indications of problems, but then the individual has got to take ownership. And if they don't take ownership, ain't going to work. And it's every one of those ingredients that we're working on. And we're working on with Veterans Affairs, with the provinces across the country. Because so much of the professional support in this country is at a professional level. And so we're working all of those to deal with the stigma tied to mental health across the board. We've tried to increase the number of mental health workers over the past 10 years to more than double. It's not enough, but it's better than on Civvy Street, I tell you. But it's tough getting the professionals where the soldiers are, in places like Wainwright, in places like Suffield, in places like Gagetown, in places like Petawawa. You know, and you understand this. But we're also benefiting from the great work of the Canadian Institute for Military and Veterans Health Research and learning more about ourselves. Our families have paid a huge toll, and their support, as I said, is absolutely essential to our operational success, to our morale, but also to the rehabilitation and reintegration of our men and women. And we've learned that we need to support our families and treat our families in order to accelerate the recovery and rehabilitation. But we also have to treat our families, because we're finding our families having the second order effects of post-traumatic stress. We now have spouses and children with PTSD because of that member who is deployed in operations. And I got to tell you my own little vignette here, my own little story. I came home from Iraq And I was in Iraq, as Jerry said, in 2004. It was a tough time in Iraq in 2004. I came home on leave, and we were living in Kingston, Ontario, and I went down for a night of sleep. Middle of the night, thunderstorm. Big thunderstorm, booming. And I tell you, I heard that first boom. I jumped up, flew up in the air, grabbed my wife. I threw her out of the bed. I said, "Take cover." And I jumped under the bed. She stood up, walked around the other side of the bed. "Okay, fool, what the heck are you doing?" And then she said, "Now, why'd you throw me out of bed? Who were you sleeping with in Baghdad?" But you know what? We're educating the force in terms of operational stress injury, post-traumatic stress. So we know what green is, what yellow is, what red is in terms of no issue, mild issues, and serious issues. And these are characteristics of the mild issues that you get over with. But it's that educating of the force, educating of the families, because the families see it first, and that's why we're focused on them. We're also working with the provinces to integrate and enhance all of the psychological support for our families and for the kids. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to sum up here and say the men and women of the Canadian Forces have maintained a high operational tempo over these past few years. And as you'll remember from your time in the service, there'll come a time when they become your newest veterans in this great institution, but they'll be asking for support. They need the services, the voices, and the camaraderie that you offer them. And they are the ones who will keep all of your and our traditions of remembrance alive across this country. And I know that you're going to reach out to every one of them in your communities and build bridges to them and haul them in. I need you to do that. And you need to show that we all care for them, part of a broader family to take care of each other and one another in our community. And you and those before you have worked so hard to advocate on behalf of our troops so they get the services and the benefits that they need and deserve. Your regional units are always ready to assist our veterans, whether by helping them with access to benefits and resources or providing housing support to our veterans. But the impact of your work is felt across our country. And so I just want to say to all of you, the leadership up here, but all of you from across this great country, I'd like to thank all of you for what you do for the Canadian Forces each and every day, whether they are in uniform or out of uniform. I'm thankful for all of your work. I'm proud of you, and I'm proud to be your Chief of Defense Staff. Thanks very much.
Thank you, General. Thank you, General. That was a very awe-inspiring talk. Thank you very much, and I'd like to present you a small token of our appreciation.
Thanks, Gordon. I thought you said it small.
Well, I'm glad that you have Navy people looking after you.
Thanks very much. Yeah, thanks very much, everybody.